So I want to continue with the teachings on the niyama, or the natural order of things, that the Buddha identified, and that when understood allows us to realize this mind and body as empty of any inherent essence or thing or enduring personality or being. And I've mentioned the organic and inorganic laws of nature, the physical, chemical, biological, botanical laws of nature, which we are heir to and must live within the constraints of. Cannot escape that. I've also mentioned the earlier today, I mentioned the first of the mental laws of nature, the karma, the law of karma, and the different kinds of mental legacy that one appears to possess. Due to the conditioning force of repetition, or the continuity conditioning. So I want to talk about the two remaining areas of natural law of the mind, or niyama of the mind, and they are citta, or consciousness, both a momentary consciousness, but also the stream of consciousness, and how that stream of consciousness unfolds from conception through all of the experiences of life to death. And I'll do that in about 15 minutes. And then, so that's citta niyama. And then there's dharma niyama, the universal truths, or the law of nature of the dharma that also we are heir to and cannot be free from, but if understood, can point to the shunyata nature of this mind-body process. So the first of these this afternoon is citta niyama. We're talking about consciousness. The Buddha's understanding of consciousness, as best I can describe it, and in the time that we have, from a practical point of view, we see that our life is a stream of discrete moments of experience. You know, from just take a period of time, or in the course of a sitting, you see, oh, there's a moment of, you know, happiness, sadness, spaced out, irritation, dullness, clarity, you know, da 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 da. And we see that, oh, this thing that we call consciousness, that's knowing life, knowing the moments of life, is pretty changeable. It's much like a sitting on the bank of a stream and just watching it's the debris flowing by. But in our life, it's not debris, it's important stuff. But we'll call it debris just for... And we can see that it's pretty obvious that there's an ongoing flow of experience, which in the aggregate we call my life. Now, if we were to stop the flow and look at any one moment of that stream, what would we see? Well, the Buddha said that in any moment, a sense object, a sound, a sight, a smell, a taste, a touch sensation, or a conceptual mental construct, a sense object comes in contact with a sense door, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, or the mind, the heart center, the mind, giving rise to sense consciousness, hearing, smelling, seeing, tasting, touching, thinking. In any one moment, these three elements come together. Sense object, sense door, sense consciousness. If they come together, if they arise together, and there is attention, there will be what we call ignition or contact between these three elements, giving rise to the sense consciousness, the seeing. It's much like, and the image they use is, you know, if you have a match and you have a matchbox and you touch that match to the, that little strip on the side of the box and you give it a little, then you ignite the flame, right? So too with the consciousness. If you have a sense object touching a sense base with this ignition element of attention and the other mental factors, then you get the flame of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sense consciousness. This is going on endlessly. Now, we see it in its in the aggregate. Right now, you know you're seeing me, or you're listening and you're understanding. You may be thinking of other things. You may be feeling sensations of sitting in the chair. You may be feeling mental sensations of tiredness, interest, boredom, confusion, what, you know, wonder, bewilderment, what's he talking about? Okay, even in the brief span of a couple of seconds, you can see that there's many different moments of consciousness being known. Seeing, hearing, smelling, they're all happening seemingly all together, all the time. Well, in fact, this understanding we have of what's going on here, Sunday afternoon in Seattle somewhere, we're having a day of practicing together with Steve, the teacher, and a group of people that are interested in the Buddhist teaching, the Dharma, and now at 2:30 in the afternoon, we're listening to a Dharma talk, right? That we agree, that's what's happening, right? Okay. That's not happening. That's the story we have constructed in our minds out of this vast, continuous igniting of consciousness with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts. And it's just an agreed on understanding that we have of what's happening. But actually, if we took it apart and looked at what's happening, in the seeing, with the eyes open, in the seeing of this thing here, what do we see? You don't see Steve. You don't see teacher. What the eye sees is, well, shape, color. That's it. Good luck. It sees shape and color. But as soon as the eye sees shape and color, the mind starts massaging that data, that shape, that color, into known or recognized concept. And it goes in there, it goes into the mind starts churning away at it, and scrolling through the index of known shapes and colors, person. Oh, then with a little more clarity, Steve, a little more clarity, speaking, oh, Dharma talk, here I am. Okay, I appear in your mind. I'm not in your mind. Shape and color are in your mind. Okay, that mental activity of creating consensual reality out of these very impersonal shapes and color and sounds and smells and touch and thoughts, the activity of creating consensual reality out of all that is guided by, conditioned by, the law of the unfolding of the stream of consciousness, this citta niyama. It's not random. It's not haphazard in most of us. Okay? We make sense. We have enough alignment in our citta niyama to agree on what we're doing here. Initially, it might seem so obvious. But when you take a look at how the mind puts it all together, there's a lot. If we actually each went away and wrote down what happened in one 30-second segment of this afternoon, we would find out how much difference there is in our mental perception of what's going on. We would find out that we didn't see the same thing, we didn't hear the same thing, we didn't think the same thing. It's like we were in different rooms of the mind. But there's enough coherence that we relate to each other. Now, when we start to practice insight practice, what we're doing is we're paying attention to, well, the obvious sense contact that arises when there's a thought, when there's a sight, when there's a sound, when there's a touch sensation. That's what we know, right? If it calls our attention, that's what we pay attention to. That's what we are aware of. If it lingers, like a mental state, it lingers, irritation, frustration, then we pay attention to that. And initially, we are seeing the consensual, conventional picture of what we understand is going on here. But as our mindfulness gets better, quicker, at recognizing what is being known, in time, mindfulness is seeing sights without concept, sounds without concept, sensations without concept, and the whole consensual reality that we have here falls apart. Stuff is being known, but not put together in this way. So now we're getting into the, and this is a very brief description, I'm sorry I can't give you more detail in the time. But now we're into seeing the activity of the mind that takes raw sense data and makes consensual reality out of it. Now in that little description I gave at the beginning, sense data comes in through the eye, the ear, the nose, whatever, and then the mind massages it into meaning. While the mind is massaging that into meaning and value, we're not actually present with reality. We're present with the activities of the mind scrolling through known, recognized events. We've lost touch with what's actually going on here. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. We're into the mind's explanation of it or creation of a reality. So we're not actually with the present moment, right? We're in the mind's machinations, massaging the last present moment into meaning. Hard to be in the present moment. Hard to be in the present moment because the present moment has no concept. There's no, it has color, it has shape, it has sound without meaning, it has sensation without location in the body, it has sight, sound, smell, taste, all of those things without it referring to a me, a you, an agreement, a place, a time, location in the body, or anything. It's just raw sense data. Well, now imagine you could just kind of sit down and have your mind drop into that place where you're just aware of sense data without meaning. If you told anybody about it, they would lock you up or give you some strong medication to help you get back on earth into consensual reality. Because, in fact, you'd be psychotic. You know, or apparently psychotic, not making sense out of ordinary reality. Can you imagine what you have to go through to deconstruct your belief, your understanding of ordinary reality, to get to that experience? The fear that you have to go through, the terror you have to go through, what you have to let go of, your ideas about yourself, your ideas about other, you have to let go of that. You have to be able to see that as a mental construct to get down to the raw data. And why do we want to get to that raw data? Because underneath that raw data is, all that raw data is conditioned by karma. The senses, the sense doors, the sense consciousness, is all conditioned by karma. Actions in the past give rise to sense consciousness, which takes objects and massages them into reality. That's all the result of karma. Without karma, not here. No karma, not here. Oh. So now, what happens when we get to the place where the karma resultants, the results of prior karma, stop appearing? Now we get into realizing the unconditioned. It's not conditioned by karma. It is the unconditioned. Now we have access to and realize Nibbana. Not of this world, not of this consensual reality at all. And it's not conditioned by prior actions. Prior karmic actions give rise to karma results. Don't give rise to the unconditioned, which is not conditioned by karma. But it can be realized. This is a very brief, but it is a brief description of the path of practice in deconstructing ordinary reality to access and realize the unconditioned. Why is that important? Accessing the unconditioned frees the mind, or uproots from the mind, some of those defilements that I talked about as the anusya profile. You know, the first time you access the unconditioned nibbana, it uproots from the mind wrong view. Thereafter, this stream of consciousness never succumbs to wrong view. No more belief in there's an inherent entity in here. There's still suffering, there's still dukkha, there's still the relative sense of here I am walking around doing my thing, but there's no belief in this. That wrong view has been uprooted from the mind. Now when one acts, having seen the unconditioned, uprooting the wrong view, now when one acts, there's no more reinforcing of this sense of self. There's an unwinding of it all. There's a lot of momentum to it. All that mental legacy that I talked about, it's got a lot of momentum to it, and it's all got to unwind, but the end is assured. They say the first time you see Nibbana, first time you access the unconditioned, the end of this momentum is assured. We don't know how long it's going to take, but for sure it's going to happen. Until that time, we wander in samsara. We really wander around kind of aimlessly. But once you've seen the unconditioned, you don't wander aimlessly anymore. The goal is in sight, and you head towards it. And that's where there's the end of suffering. End of suffering. I'm gonna continue with this. This is just a very, very brief description of the stream of consciousness from, you know, our ordinary life, which comes into recognition with when we're born, but actually before that, when there's conception, and maybe even before that, if you understand karma the way the Buddha did. And then what happens to that stream of consciousness as one practices and develops mindfulness and understanding of what one is mindful of? Then gradually we come to see through the illusion that this tapestry of mind and body phenomena weaves of this sense of self, and you see through it. All the threads are still there, but the perception and understanding is so refined that you see through the threads into what is beyond the conditioned, which is the unconditioned. The unfolding of this knowledge is not accidental, it's not haphazard, it's well mapped out. Hundreds of thousands of people have gone through this, have used this practice to go through that process to realize the unconditioned and uproot this wrong view. Hundreds of thousands. Many people in the West also, Westerners, also gone through, seen that. Why is it important? It's because it assures one of the end of suffering. Until then, we're wandering blindly, hoping, wishing, looking for happiness in all the wrong places. But once the stream has touched and realized the unconditioned, that's why it's so valuable to both hear that there is a path and to have some knowledge of it. It bolsters our faith in and confidence in practice and in the teachings and teachers who can share those teachings to guide us. And it is a reality. The unconditioned is a reality that can be realized and very transformative. For a more detailed explanation of Chitta Niyama, you'd have to get into the Abhidhamma, or you'd have to come to an Abhidhamma retreat or something like that, or listen to Abhidhamma talks on the web. But it's instructive, it's informative, we can't say that it's a commandment of how the mind unfolds, but it's laws that govern the unfolding of the mind when we develop mindfulness, when we develop awareness. So that's brief Chitta Niyama, the stream of consciousness as it unfolds through ordinary life, creation of reality, and through the deconstruction of ordinary reality to glimpse the unconditioned. Dharma Niyama, or the laws of nature, of the way things are, is pointing to Dharma, pointing to maybe most specifically and most precisely for our understanding of practice, it points to the three characteristics. It is, and they are, as you know, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca means impermanence. All things are impermanent. All conditioned things are impermanent. Now, do you believe that? Do you believe all conditioned things are impermanent? Or, if you're not sure, show me something that is not impermanent. Well, the earth, the universe, whatever, or whatever you can think of. Actually, if you have a large enough time frame in the mind, whatever you can call up in your mind, you'll see has a life. It comes into existence, it endures for a while, and eventually it passes away. Even the earth, the sun, the universe, the Big Bang, the small bang, the imploding black space of whatever, you know, let alone a human being or any plant or any species. Brief flickerings in this eternal, you know, expanse of time that just goes on and on. Why is that important? Why is it necessary to hear about that? Well, because we spend our life, much of it, trying to create permanence out of things that cannot offer permanence. We look for permanence, stability, security in people, in institutions, in careers, in jobs, in houses, in, you know, earthquake-proof underpinnings of our house, in, you know, car insurance, health insurance, whatnot. And it's good that we do that. You know, it provides some mistaken belief that we're safe. Man, I tell you, this Buddhist stuff. But actually, when we understand, when we hear the teachings that things are impermanent, we're not quite so, it's not quite so believable that we're going to be that secure. We're going to be that safe. We're going to be, that things are going to be unchanging. And we build in, you know, a kind of a reasonable expectation and not to be surprised when things change. That's skillful. That's really healthy. That's a good mental habit to have. You know, whatever you're investing in is not going to last. Yeah. You know, it's not, you know, what your government or your partner or your boss or others might want you to believe, but that's the way it is. That's the way it is. So, bringing our life more into alignment with this understanding is wisdom. Wisdom anticipates consequences. That's what wisdom does. Wisdom is the anticipation of consequences. And if we know that things are going to change, we're going to live and act and make different decisions than if we think, I can make this last forever. I can make this solid, secure, stable, anything. Cannot. Okay. The second Dharma, Niyama, the way things are in the Dharma, the way things are in reality, is that all conditioned things have the characteristic of dukkha. This is the First Noble Truth. Right? Now, any of you that heard my dukkha rap, you know I got a long rap on dukkha. You know, Kama calls me the dukkha king. Because I really can riff on dukkha. But what does it mean? Dukkha means pain. Physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain. It's a fact, right? It's a fact. Nobody can deny it. Well, only those who are heavily deluded can deny it. But it's a fact. But there's subtler meanings of dukkha, one of which is the insecurity because things change. That too is dukkha. Even though things are pleasant right now, we may be healthy, we may have, you know, good relationships, good job, good car, good house, good weather, good, you know, and it's all fine now, that's dukkha. Why? Well, because it changes unpredictably. It changes. And so we can't really rest on the pleasantness of any experience with security. And we know that. We know that. Somewhere just over the horizon of our willingness is this knowledge that it's all pretty unstable. And we live with this anxiety-provoking truth. But if we just said, yeah, this is the way it is. It's just unstable. And dealt with that, this feeling of insecurity, we'd be much better off than trying to stabilize the unstable. And then the third, as you know, my third understanding of dukkha is that we're born, we live out our life, doing the best we can to be healthy, happy, harmonious with others, and we take care of this body, we take care of this mind, doing everything we can, go to school, get a job, entertain ourselves endlessly, learn the Dharma, practice as much as we can, all that. And then, in spite of all of our vitamins, all of our yoga, all of our aerobic exercise, we die. It's like, bummer. You know, and if all we're doing in life is just carrying this body and mind to the grave as comfortably as possible, well, as I've said before, we're wasting our time. We can learn so much more. We can get so much more out of this life if we practice the Dharma than if we just try to experience pleasantness. So I hate to be the bearer of good news when it's in the form of dukkha. But actually, dukkha is really good news because we shouldn't be surprised. You know, Dharma people should never be surprised at dukkha. Never. With all the unpleasantness, all the pain, all of should not be surprised ever when it comes. We've heard it. You know, we're practicing it. We're trying to get it. You know, just the extent of it in our life. Doesn't mean you got to walk around depressed and despairing because it's all dukkha. That's not. Because it's the understanding of dukkha, the full accepting understanding of dukkha that frees you from the feeling of dukkha. Now, I'm talking about the difference between the feelings of dukkha and the knowledge or wisdom of dukkha. The knowledge of dukkha, well, uproots the feeling of dukkha in the mind. So we have to be, you know, and in a course of our practice, as we're exposed to and come to terms with dukkha, we actually free the mind from suffering. This is the way it is. This is the way it is. It's not like the Buddha invented it and said, oh, dukkha is a good concept to have in this spiritual tradition. It's not that. He kind of observed it and said, this is the way things are. And when we have this knowledge and we practice with this knowledge to realize it for ourselves, we too free ourselves from the grasping that creates dukkha, that causes dukkha, and enhance our life and our sense of well-being because we learn how to let go. And then the third knowledge or characteristic of phenomena that we learn with through practice, Dhamma Niyama, is the anatta characteristic, shunyata, that I've been talking about all weekend, that, you know, they're really, things are unstable. Our sense of ourself is unreal. It's not supported by anything if you pay attention carefully. So, as Ajahn Chah would say, be kind to yourself. Let go. Let go. It's let go in the mind, really. It's let go of this idea of ourself. You know, I'm like this. And while we can see the mental momentum of this legacy that we've inherited from the past and are working on in the present, we don't have to hang on to it. We can live in alignment with the way things are, let go as much as we can, cultivate the wholesome, change the mental legacy for the future, and in time let go of this mistaken belief and free ourselves from suffering. Possible. That's why we have this weekend. That's why this is the topic of the weekend, this weekend, so that we can all get a little more familiar with the concepts, the teachings of the Buddha, and use them to support our practice and to guide the unfolding of our practice. You know, there's a lot of spiritual teachers in the world today. Every tradition has got many speaking for it. And there's all kinds of topics and techniques and tools and all kinds of things, all of which at some time and place could be really beneficial to you. But we should understand where in the whole path of awakening they are effective. Because every tool, every technique, every tradition has its strengths, benefits, times of applicability when it's really effective, and they have their limitations. They're just not able to offer everything you need for the whole path. No one technique, no one understanding, no one tool. And so, you know, we use them as we need them and move on. So, where am I going with this? Well, that's the way it is. And to the extent that we have the knowledge and we live in alignment, or we try to bring our intentions and our actions into alignment with the way things are, we will suffer less. And to the extent that we cannot yet, then we we undermine our own happiness. You know, and we don't need to blame ourselves. We do the best we can. And if you practice consistently, practice awareness consistently, and seek understanding, then gradually we get understanding. Gradually we see this is the way it is. And, you know, as I mentioned before, it's hard to live in denial of what you know, what you really know from your own efforts. And when you make those efforts and you learn, you know for yourself, this is the way it is, you have to really be, you have to really work hard to become deluded again. You can, but you got to really work hard at it. And it's suffering all every step of the way. So it's better to learn through suffering. You know, they say there's two kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of holding on, and there's the suffering of letting go. Pick your pick. But no. It's like, you know, when you hold on to something, you know, you take anything. You grab onto it, and I say, hold on to this, or just squeeze your fist. You just squeeze your fist. Squeeze. Okay. You know, you're squeezing your fist, and after, you know, 3 minutes, oh, wow, it begins to hurt, and it gets really stiff and achy, and after 5 minutes, it gets numb, and after 10 minutes, you can't even feel it anymore. Still holding on, can't feel it, though. So we're totally numb. Go around life. Carry your fist like this, hanging on in your mind to whatever you're hanging on to. Your idea of yourself. You're hanging on to this idea of yourself. You're numb to it. You don't know it anymore because just holding on has gone numb. Then that holding on is suffering that leads to more suffering. You don't even know you're suffering, but it's suffering. Now some Buddhist teacher comes along and says, hey, what are you holding on to? Oh, I'm holding on to... Holding on? I'm not holding on to anything. Oh, well, why don't you open your fist? Oh, so then you try to open your fist, and it's like... all the aches, all the pain, all the numbness, all the stiffness, tension becomes apparent as you try to open your fist, or as you try to open your mind, right? It all becomes apparent. So it's suffering to let go. You open up the mind, you open up the heart, you open up your fist. It's suffering. It's really painful. But once the mind, once the hand or fist is open, free. No more pain. No more discomfort. No more stiffness, tension, holding, aching, numbness. Let go. Same thing in the mind. To open the mind and to let go of all that the mind is holding on to, really painful. But it's the pain that leads to the end of suffering, rather than the pain that leads to more suffering. This is the pain that leads to more suffering. This is the pain that leads to the end of suffering. So you want to be sure what kind of pain you're enduring. You know, if it's this kind of pain, turn it around. This kind of pain. Because in letting go, we come to, we see temporary and then eventually enduring end of suffering. Sounds like a good deal, huh? Well, that's the Dharma practice. That's the law of nature of the Dharma. If you practice in that way, you will see these three characteristics, and you will have to let go. You'll have to let go. They'll command you to let go, or you can only see them to the extent that you let go. And in the seeing of these three characteristics, you free the mind. It works, you know. Why do you think you're here? Some of you have been coming here for, you know, well, at least 2 days, and some of you have been coming for three decades to listen to the Dharma, to practice the Dharma, to get encouragement to do that. Well, we don't do that because we're waiting for the magic bullet. We've already seen the magic bullet. It actually works. You know, awareness actually works. Understanding actually works. Faith actually works to free the mind from its limitations and suffering. So, carry on. That's good. You're doing well. Just keep doing it. The end.